Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're looking at something, well, something truly fundamental. We're getting into the playbook used by this tiny, tiny fraction of humanity material scientists, maybe 0.000004% of the population, to literally manipulate matter.
It sounds specialized, and it is, but this knowledge is just so crucial. It's what makes the difference between a material that just exists and one that can actually perform under, you know, incredible stress or extreme temperatures.
Absolutely. And for this deep dive, our source is a foundational text excerpt from Phase Transitions by Hadisha and Yon. Our mission today is to really unpack this logic. We'll look at the mechanisms, the thermodynamic drivers like entropy, and the kinetics that govern these changes.
And we'll connect these, you know, seemingly abstract ideas to real-world things, from jet engines all the way to the electronics you use every day.
So to start, what exactly is a phase in this context? We're not just talking solid, liquid, gas, are we?
No, not at all. In material science, a phase is any region that's, well, that's uniform. It has the same composition, the same atomic arrangement, and a transformation is just how that material responds to a change in its environment. Heat, pressure, even a magnetic field.
And when a material decides to transform, it basically has two ways to go about it. Let's start with the one that sounds like the most work, the reconstructive transformation.
Right. This is the total overhaul. I mean, think of it like tearing down a building brick by brick and then using those bricks to build something completely new.
So you're breaking all the atomic bonds.
Every single one. And then you rearrange the atoms into a totally new pattern.
Yeah.
And for that to happen, the atoms have to physically move around.
Which means diffusion is essential.
Exactly. Diffusion atoms changing their location is non-negotiable. And because of that movement, the new phase often ends up with a different chemical composition than what it started with. A classic example is seeing tiny particles of Ni4Ti3 precipitating inside a nickel-titanium alloy. Those particles have a totally different chemistry than the metal around them.
Okay, so that's the slow, deliberate, reconstructive path. What's the alternative, the faster, more elegant one?
That would be the displacive transformation. Now, instead of breaking every bond, this is more like a coordinated, uniform deformation. The original atomic pattern sort of shears into a new crystal structure.
Like a quick, organized atomic dance instead of a slow scramble?
That's a perfect way to put it. And because there's no long-range diffusion, the chemical composition stays exactly the same.
So what's the condition for this to happen? It can't just happen anytime, right?
You're right. There's a very specific quantitative condition. Displacive changes really only happen when atomic mobility is, well, limited.
Meaning
the interface, you know, the boundary between the old and new phase.
Yeah.
It has to be moving faster than the atoms can physically diffuse. The speed of that wall has to outrun them.
Ah, so if diffusion could keep up, the system would just default back to the slower reconstructive path.
Precisely. The most famous example, of course, is martensite in steel. It's what makes steel so hard. When it forms, you can actually see these little upheavals on the polished surface of the metal. That's direct proof of that coordinated shear motion.
And it's not just metals. We see this in ceramics, too, which is just incredible. Barium titanate, for example.
Yes, a key material for capacitors. It starts with a simple cubic structure. But as it cools, the titanium atom in the middle shifts just a tiny bit off center.
And that little nudge is everything.
It's everything. That tiny coordinated displacement changes the symmetry and gives it an incredibly high relative permittivity. So a small atomic shift leads to this massive functional performance.
Okay, so we've covered the how. Now we need to get into the why. What's the actual driving force? And that brings us to thermodynamics, doesn't it?
It does. Thermodynamics is basically the language we use to connect observable things like heat flow to what's happening internally with the atoms. We talk about internal energy and enthalpy. Enthalpy is basically the heat content of the system.
And that tells you if a reaction releases heat or absorbs it.
Exactly. And today, we can measure this routinely with something called differential scanning calorimetry, or DSC. You just heat up a tiny little sample and measure the heat flow.
And that data, that trace, it tells a whole story. Let's take the example of an iron-rich metallic glass. So this is a material where the atoms are all jumbled up, right? Frozen in place.
Yes, completely amorphous. And as you heat it, right around 520 Kelvin, you see this sudden step change in the DSC output.
That's the glass transition temperature, Chi. What's actually happening there?
The material is relaxing. The atoms get just enough energy to sort of loosen up a bit. They don't crystallize, not yet. But they can move enough to change the material's heat capacity. It's like a stiff plastic just starting to get rubbery.
But if you keep heating it?
If you keep pushing it, yes. Around 700 Kelvin, the glass gives up and crystallizes. And on the DSC plot, that shows up as a big, sharp, inverted peak.
Inverted because it's releasing heat, not absorbing it.
Exactly. It's an exothermic reaction. The system is releasing all that stored energy as the atoms snap into their nice, ordered, low-energy crystal positions.
But the real engine behind all of this, the concept that governs mixing and ordering, is entropy.
Ah, yes. Entropy. It quantifies the amount of disorder, you know, the number of ways you can arrange the atoms. And here's the really profound insight.
Which is?
Configurational entropy always favors mixing. Always. There are just fundamentally more ways to arrange atoms in a mixed up state than in a separated pure state.
So how does that compete with the fact that some atoms want to be ordered? Like in brass, where copper and zinc atoms prefer to be next to each other because it releases energy.
Right, so that preference for AB bonds means the enthalpy is negative, which favors order. But the total free energy has that TS term, temperature times entropy. At low temperatures, enthalpy wins, you get order. But as you crank up the heat, that TS term becomes huge and it just overwhelms everything. Disorder wins.
And this idea that high temperatures favor disorder is the whole philosophy behind high entropy alloys, or HEAs.
Absolutely. It's a brilliant strategy. You take five or more elements in roughly equal amounts to just maximize that configurational entropy.
You're basically making the system so chaotic, so full of options,
that it just gives up on trying to form complex, ordered structures.
Yeah.
That's a great way to think about it. The massive disorder forces it to just settle for a simple, single solid solution, like a face-centered cubic structure.
Like that famous CRM-M Fekkonen alloy. It forms a single, simple structure, even though most of its components wouldn't do that on their own.
And this isn't just for metals. We're now seeing high-entropy ceramics for things like thermoelectric materials, like you'd find in a satellite power source.
Yeah.
The high entropy, the disorder, gives you low thermal conductivity, which is good, while still getting high electrical output. It's a perfect example of harnessing disorder.
So we have the mechanism and the driving force. The last piece of the puzzle is speed. How fast does it all happen? And that is all about kinetics and diffusion.
Right. And just as a quick reminder, diffusion in solids is atoms jumping into empty spots or vacancies. And there's a huge difference between how different atoms move.
You mean interstitial versus substitutional?
Exactly. Small atoms, like carbon and iron, are interstitial. They put in the gaps. They can just hop from gap to gap very easily.
Because the gaps are mostly empty.
They're mostly empty, so they diffuse incredibly fast. And this is the basis for carburizing steel. You take a gear or a bearing, you heat it in a carbon-rich atmosphere, and that carbon sips into the surface layer,
creating a super hard outer case while the inside stays tough and ductile.
Precisely. Now let's get a little deeper into the driving force for diffusion. We usually say it's driven by a concentration gradient, but that's a simplification.
What's the real driver then?
It's actually a gradient in what we call chemical potential. The system is always trying to minimize its free energy, not just even out the concentration.
Okay, and this is where things can get, well, a bit weird. Because if it's about energy, not concentration, you can get something called uphill diffusion.
Yes. It's one of the most counterintuitive ideas in the field. It's where atoms will actually diffuse up a concentration gradient from a region of low concentration to a region of high concentration.
Wait, how is that possible? That's like people willingly moving into an already packed room.
It sounds impossible. But the atoms are still flowing downhill in terms of energy. Imagine a sort of energy landscape with dips and valleys. The atoms are just flowing into a local energy valley, even if that valley happens to correspond to a higher concentration of those atoms. It's following the path of least energetic resistance.
That's a mind bender. So what about the structure itself? Defects must play a huge role in diffusion speed.
A massive role.
Yeah.
Grain boundaries, the interfaces between different crystal grains, are basically high-speed highways for diffusion.
Yeah.
It's so much easier for an atom to move along that disordered boundary than through the perfect crystal lattice.
But that's temperature dependent, isn't it?
Oh, very much so. At lower temperatures, the grain boundary highway is the dominant path. But at very high temperatures, like in a jet engine, the atoms in the bulk lattice are vibrating so much that they start to diffuse quickly too. So at high heat, the bulk diffusion starts to take over.
And that's a huge problem for something like a turbine blade, which is operating at over 1500 degrees Celsius. Those grain boundaries become weak spots.
They become sources of creep, where the material deforms under stress. So the engineering solution was, well, it was brilliant. Just get rid of them.
Get rid of the grain boundaries entirely.
Yes. Turbine blades evolve from being polycrystalline, lots of grains, to directionally solidified, and finally, to being grown as a single perfect crystal.
One enormous grain.
One giant grain. They use a little spiral at the bottom of the mold during solidification to select just one crystal orientation and grow it all the way up. No grain boundaries means incredible creep resistance.
So let's talk about that process solidification. The birth of a new phase starts with something called nucleation.
And nucleation is the hardest part. Just for a new phase to pop up spontaneously in a perfect material, that's homogeneous nucleation, it requires overcoming a huge energy barrier. You have to supercool a pure liquid by hundreds of degrees.
Which almost never happens in the real world. In reality, we have heterogeneous nucleation.
Right. In reality, nucleation happens on things that are already there. Defects, impurities, the walls of the container. These act as templates, which dramatically lowers that energy barrier and makes it much easier to get started.
And when you're solidifying an alloy with multiple elements, things get even more complicated. You get solute partitioning.
It just means the elements prefer to be in either the solid or the liquid phase.
Mm.
As the solid grows, it kicks out the elements it doesn't want, piling them up in the liquid just ahead of the solidification front.
And that creates a problem, doesn't it? It leads to constitutional supercooling.
It does. That pileup of solute lowers the melting point of the liquid right at the interface. So you end up with a zone of liquid that is, for its new composition, technically supercooled, even if the overall temperature is dropping smoothly.
And this instability is what causes the solidification front to break down.
It breaks down completely. Instead of a nice flat front, you get these complex, tree-like branching structures. We call them dendrites. You see them everywhere in cast metals.
So engineers trying to control this. One way is with eutectic alloys, right?
Eutectics are a clever solution. You pick a composition that has a single, sharp, low melting point. The key is that the solid that forms has the same composition as the liquid, so there's no solute partitioning, no dendrites. It's perfect for things like solder or engine blocks.
Okay, finally, let's talk about strengthening materials after they're solid, like the aluminum alloys in an airplane. This is where we use metastable precipitation.
Right. This is age hardening. You're trying to grow tiny hard particles inside the metal. Now, the final most stable particle you want in aluminum copper, it's a phase called theta, is actually very difficult to nucleate.
Why? If it's the most stable, shouldn't it be the easiest to form?
You'd think so, but this is the perfect summary of kinetics versus thermodynamics. The stable theta phase is the biggest energy payoff, but it has a huge startup cost, a massive activation energy.
Because its crystal structure is a poor match for the aluminum around it.
An awful match. The interfacial energy is huge. So instead, the system first forms a sequence of less stable, metastable precipitates. They don't give you as much of an energy drop, but they're a much better structural fit.
So their activation energy, their startup cost, is much lower.
Much lower. So kinetics wins the race. The easier to start, wrong phase forms first because it has a lower barrier to entry. It's a beautiful example of the path of least resistance.
So tying this all together, we've gone from reconstructive versus displacive changes to the power of entropy in creating high entropy alloys to the bizarre reality of uphill diffusion, and finally to controlling microstructures in everything from jet engines to airplane wings.
What it all means is that these fundamental rules give us a predictive power. We can model these free energies and kinetic barriers to design new materials in a computer before we ever melt a single gram of metal in a lab.
And here's a final thought for you to take away. These laws of phase transitions, they don't just apply here on Earth. Think about the ice giants, Uranus and Neptune.
The conditions in their cores are just immense, unbelievable pressures and temperatures. Under those conditions, the methane is thought to break down.
And the carbon.
The carbon is predicted to transform. It converts into diamond. Or it might even alloy with metallic hydrogen.
People have literally called them diamonds in the sky. And our ability to model these extreme phase diagrams is absolutely critical to understanding the structure of planets in depth space. Knowing how matter changes isn't just about making a better airplane part. It's about understanding the entire cosmos.